How did you get interested in mushrooms?
By complete accident.
Christian Schwarz is a mycologist, and for those of you who might not know what that is, you probably can guess by now. It's someone who studies mushrooms. Many of us walk through forests looking up at the branches and the sky, but Christian scans the ground constantly in search of fungi. He specializes in mushrooms that grow in California's redwood forests, and when one such forest burned, he was eager to see what he would find.
I'd never seen a wildfire in redwood forest at all. I'd never seen a burned redwood forest, much less a high-intensity burn in a redwood forest. So I had no idea what to expect. And it was like nothing I'd ever seen when I finally did get back. It was total. You know, it was complete.
I'm Sarah Goodwin with the Science Communication Lab, a nonprofit dedicated to science storytelling. I talked to Christian for a documentary film we produced about the aftermath of the massive wildfire in Big Basin, California's oldest state park. It was fascinating to hear his perspective on the forest, the fire, and what might come next. But first, I wanted to start with his fascination with all things mushrooms.
I'm a mushroom-focused nature educator is how I would describe it. I do a number of things. I am a instructor at the Nora Center for Natural History at UC Santa Cruz. I teach natural history of fungi there. And I'm also a research associate of the Nora Center, as well as at the Santa Barbara Botanic Gardens.
Love that. And how did you get interested in mushrooms?
By complete accident, almost by inversion, because I really didn't like them at first. I thought they were horrible. They were my least favorite food, and so I didn't want to pay any attention to them. And then my brother got interested in them and kind of convinced me to look at them out on a hike in the woods, and I got completely hooked almost instantly. It was a really rainy year, which was rare in San Diego, where I grew up. And there was just mushrooms everywhere of all different colors, and I couldn't stop looking after that. And here we are, almost two decades later. Be careful what you pay attention to.
And what is it about mushrooms that has kept your attention for the last couple decades?
I think it really is the visual diversity. I'm very sense-oriented in general, and especially sensitive to art and visual stimuli, and mushrooms scratch that itch for me. There's so many textures and colors and shapes and sizes and forms that I can never get enough. Even the most familiar mushrooms that I've seen 1,000 times, things that grow in the woods just up the hill from me, I still get a kick out of seeing just another variation of the same species or a particularly beautifully formed fruit body. I think they're just, they satisfy my visual curiosity.
And what in general are the mushrooms that you're particularly interested in? What's their role in the natural flow of life?
Well, the one everyone knows is as decomposers. So they break down dead organic matter and they help various nutrient cycles start over. That's a core, undeniable, major role that fungi play in global ecosystems, but it's certainly not the only one. One of the groups of fungi that I really like are the mycorrhizal fungi. So these are not eating dead organic matter. They're getting their carbon, the fuel for their metabolism, their sugar, directly from a living host, unprocessed. Sugar comes straight from the leaf, down the twig and the branch and the trunk into the roots, and the fungi absorb it right there at the point of contact with the plant. So it hasn't been turned into wood or leaves or any sort of tissue that has to then die and be degraded the way most fungi get their nutrition. These are fungi that are directly in touch with a living source of carbon. So they are a major mutualistic symbiont of woody plants all around the world. In fact, not just woody plants, all plants, with very few exceptions. I think 80 to 90% of all land plants have some sort of mycorrhizal partner. It enables these plants to live in places where they otherwise wouldn't be able to grow, because in exchange for all that sugar, the fungal partner is sending water, soil nutrients, phosphorus, nitrogen, things like that to the plant that's hosting it and providing its metabolic, you know, carbohydrates. So there's that aspect of fungal ecology. But then there's also parasites, fungi that are detrimental to the health of another organism that they live in close contact with. So they can play major roles in disease ecology in forest ecosystems, and they can determine what the long-term trajectory of a forest's succession looks like because of which trees they kill and which trees they don't kill. And then there's fungal pathogens of animals. So there are lots and lots of insect-specific pathogens that cause all sorts of crazy diseases, including some that have what can only be described as mind control. They are in touch with the nervous system of their host insect, and they change its behavior in ways that are really radical.
That's intense. I think I've seen some of those pictures of the mutant ants or zombie ants, I guess they call
exactly,
them.
Exactly, the zombie ants.
And are like, is there kind of a rough percentage of like how many mushroom species are symbionts and how many are parasitic, and or is it just you can't really quantify it?
You could if you had a better list, but the problem is our list. We don't have anywhere near a robust picture of the biodiversity of fungi on the planet. I would say that without trying to assign percentages, a majority of fungi are probably some version of decomposers, decaying dead organic matter and getting their metabolic needs met that way. But beyond that very broad generalization, I couldn't confidently or honestly give you very good relative percentages or proportions of how many fungi do each of those three lifestyles.
Well, I'm curious, like, let's go into kind of these fires and Big Basin. Like, could you tell me a little bit about your experience with Big Basin and kind of what that area has meant to you and your work?
Yeah, it's a heavy topic because Big Basin previously was probably the piece of land with which I was most familiar on Earth. I've probably been there more repeatedly than any other place other than maybe the UC Santa Cruz campus. So it was really sort of the core wild area that my heart had gotten to know, both before I studied it on purpose when I was just going there as a naturalist, as well as after I started really intensely studying it and visiting it on a regular repeated schedule for 3 years and counting all of the mushrooms that I saw. So I was both doing general natural history as well as a focused study there in the years leading up to the fire. And, you know, I'd been familiar with Big Basin since probably 2007. So I had known it for about 13 years by the time it burned.
What makes Big Basin so special? Why were you spending so much time there?
Well, Big Basin represented the southernmost last great stand of old growth redwoods. There is nothing like it around. You know, you don't go to Monterey to see big old growth redwoods. They are there in Monterey and San Luis Obispo counties, but they don't do what they do up at Prairie Creek, up in Humboldt, where they get to be some of the world's tallest and most biomassive trees. But in Santa Cruz, they did sort of have that flavor at Big Basin. They did sort of seem like they were in that class of the world's most enormous trees. They lived up to that redwood mythology. And everything that came along with that old growth nature, that old growth quality. There was more mushrooms there and of a diversity that you don't really find anywhere else in the Monterey Bay bioregion. A lot of representatives of northern species came down to Big Basin and didn't go any further. So it was sort of a southern outpost of a lot of northern species, not only fungi, but plants. Amphibians sort of reached their southern limit here in Santa Cruz in many cases. It was a way of going hundreds of miles north while just traveling a few miles uphill.
I didn't know that. Is it the climate in the Santa Cruz that allows for this kind of northern growth down there? Or what's special about that region that allows for this?
Well, it's a combination of things. A, the climate. We are at the northern end of Monterey Bay, and the cooling effects of that sort of intrusion of the ocean further back inland allowed for it, at least historically, a lot of summer fog, and the fact that Big Basin is right at the top of the otherwise very modest Santa Cruz Mountains. You know, 2,000 feet elevation is not very high, but it's big enough of a rise from sea level that it would catch a lot more moisture out of incoming storms from the west. So the combination of the Monterey Bay as well as its moderate elevation allowed for that forest to get enough water to even grow. But then it also got lucky in being spared from logging in the early days of Santa Cruz's being converted to lumber, or in some cases being burned for the lime kilns. So one of the major exports from here was lime for the production of concrete in San Francisco to rebuild the city after the earthquake. And some of the trees weren't even used for lumber. They were just used as fuel to burn the limestone into lime. So Big Basin was lucky in that it did not get, at least not uniformly, logged the way some of the other areas did. There was true remnants of old growth that had never been logged.
What are some of the exciting mushroom species that you find in an old growth forest like Big Basin?
Well, it varies. There is no suite of mushrooms that is uniformly old growth. It depends where you are in the world. But Big Basin, being dominated by coast redwoods, Douglas fir, tan oak, had really a mix of everything. So redwoods are special because they are non-ectomycorrhizal. They don't do that kind of symbiosis I was mentioning earlier, not with mushroom-forming fungi anyways. So they have a particular suite of fungi that are associated with them, but they're not of the ectomycorrhizal lifestyle. They're things that we call waxy caps. So these are these beautiful, I call them the rainbow genus, because they come in blues and reds and oranges, greens, violets, whites, blacks. There's really no color that you can't find among the waxy caps. That's one of the groups that you expect to see in any redwood forest, but especially diverse with some of the more rare and beautiful species growing in the old growth forests. But there's also sort of the sister group, not sister evolutionarily, but sister ecologically, the pink-spored mushrooms, the Entolomatacea. And that's probably my favorite family of mushrooms to pay attention to. And they're kind of the opposite. They are dark and shadowy, and they come in purples and blues and blacks, but always very, very hard to see. They're not bright. They're somber, and they sort of keep their beauty a little more hidden. But then if you put them under the microscope, their spores are shaped like stars and boxes and coffins, really amazing angular constructions. And so I really like that group. And you can always find them together in redwoods. So those are two groups that I always, you know, when I woke up and I knew I was going to Big Basin that day, that's what had me rubbing my hands together. I wonder what I'll see. Is it going to be waxy caps or pink spored mushrooms? One of the two. I'm going to see something really beautiful, some representative of those groups.
Take me to the fire. The whole kind of Santa Cruz area, you know, that was not just Big Basin that was affected by the fire. But I guess, could you just kind of describe what that time was like and what you were thinking, like even before you went back to Big Basin after the fire had passed through?
Yeah, the first night that the fire started was really weird because it was the middle of the summer and we had a lightning storm. So there was like 200 or 300 lightning strikes in the space of a couple hours, which is absolutely out of character for Santa Cruz. That's not the kind of weather we really ever have. Even during the stormy season, lightning is fairly rare and very modest here compared to other parts of the United States. So to have 200 lightning strikes in a couple hours in the middle of the summer was, it felt like you were no longer in a place that you knew. You know, I think a lot of people kind of were excited. It was sort of an ecstatic feeling when it was happening because it was so strange and kind of impressive. But once you realized how dry the vegetation was at that time of year, because this was the middle of the summer, that there were going to be consequences. There's no way that you can have 200 lightning strikes fall on dry vegetation and not have a fire. And that's exactly what we got. By the next morning, I had seen notifications that there was a fire on China Grade, which is right outside Big Basin. And, you know, I sort of understood at that moment that a fire was happening, but I did not think it would become what it did. In my mind, quite consciously, this wasn't even subconscious, I thought that Big Basin would never burn. I thought that it was of the type of forest where there's so much moisture in it just all the time because of the huge, you know, volume of the trees and the plants that live there. And there's so many creeks that, given our climate, where we don't get a lot of lightning, that there's no way it could ever burn, not to the degree that it did. So the combination of factors that led to its burning, not just a little bit, but literally 95% of the park burning in high-intensity crown fire, left me realizing that there is no climate outcome that is impossible to imagine. Any emergency, any worst-case scenario can happen. And that's what I realized afterwards, that the thing that I thought least likely and most painful happened. And that leaves you sort of free in a way, because you have the thing that you most wanted not to lose is now lost, that it happened. But it also makes you realize that this is impossible to treat as a hypothetical scenario. I don't really believe in people still talking about stopping climate change. That seems to be a radically silly foregone conclusion. Climate change is here. Climate has changed. It's a past tense verb. Climate changed. After the fire, I didn't know what to expect. First of all, I didn't know when I'd be allowed to get back in, because it burned, as you know, until January with active flames. Even when I went back in November, I think, or October was the month they let me back in, there were still flames on the ground. I would find logs that were still not just smoldering, but had lapping flames. I continued to find smoldering trunks and hollows into January, even after the rains had come, because the root system burns deep in the soil, far below where the rains will ever soak it. Now I'm getting ahead of myself. That's what I saw when I went back, but I didn't know what to expect. I'd never seen a wildfire in redwood forest at all. I'd never seen a burned redwood forest, much less a high-intensity burn in a redwood forest. So I had no idea what to expect. And it was like nothing I'd ever seen when I finally did get back. It was total. You know, it was complete. The fire had, in many places, turned the ground to a homogeneous layer of ash that was very white. And the trees were all black, and the trees were very straight. There were no branches left. So it was a landscape divided by the sky and the ground. The sky is blue, the ground is white, the trees are black. Three colors and three shapes. The trees are all straight, the ground is flat white, and then maybe there's some clouds in the sky. So in many places, it was that stark. Obviously, in other places, it was more complicated. But in some places, the fire was as intense as it's possible for a fire to be. You know, it turned all the redwoods into fuel and burned them all. That said, they all survived. Almost all the redwoods survived. I mean, there's mortality for sure, but almost all of them are resprouting epicormically. So they have cloaks of green branches emerging. That was absolutely not the case for the Douglas fir. It was not the case for the tan oak. Douglas fir just die flat out. They are fire sensitive. They're sort of the far extreme end of a plant's response to fire. They just perish. They burn, and they don't have any regenerative resprouting abilities. Their seeds are not fire adapted. So there's virtually no Douglas fir left in the park anymore. Big change. I'm less sad about that, though, because Douglas fir are expanding. They are something that's going to come back into the park over time. That is not a tree that we expect to be extirpated. Paradoxically, it's the regenerating redwoods that are still most at risk. And the reason is, even though they can regenerate, even though they can resprout with this amazing sort of life force that they have in their insulated bark, they need long-term support from water that they're less and less likely to get in the coming decades. So you can survive the extremely severe inflected disturbance, but that says nothing about your ability to persist if the climate context around you changes. So I still think that even though we see this very big difference in mortality between the two major conifers of the park, Douglas fir and redwood, it's paradoxically the ones that died that are less of a concern and the ones that resprouted that are still more of a concern.
Why did the fire burn so intensely?
There's multiple reasons for that. One is that there had been no historical continuity of human wildfire. So Native Americans in our area would set yearly, annual small fires that were for the creation of a habitat that favored the growth of favored food plants or allowed deer to concentrate in a place so they could be hunted more easily. And that was a major co-evolved part of the system here, is that there would be occasional clearing events where a low-intensity wildfire would remove a lot of the fuel loads from the understory of a forest. But even that really couldn't have prevented something like what we saw, which is so many ignitions, so many points of fire starting due to this dense lightning event, that eventually there's just going to be enough fire that has taken hold in a forest that it can become a crown fire, that it can go up the canopy and become totalizing, burn a Douglas fir, use that entire tree as fuel, not just the leaf litter around it, not just the fallen logs, but the standing biomass of a Douglas fir can become fuel. And once that is happening, and once you have a high proportion of Douglas fir in a forest, no amount of prescribed burning really could have stopped that. So unfortunately, it's both. And I'm not a fire scientist. There's people who are way more qualified to hypothesize about the structure of this fire than I am. But from what I can tell, from what I understand, that is the two major components that made this fire as bad as it was.
Take me into Big Basin after this fire, thinking about what we were filming you looking for. Could you tell us a little bit about what did it feel like to be back in the park after the fire?
I was in the third and final year of a long-term mushroom monitoring project that I had started. So I was counting the number of species and the number of fruit bodies of each species. So the number of individual mushrooms that I saw representing each of the species that were present. And that's what I had done for the prior 2 years. I would visit these transects that I'd set up, permanent transects all around the county, and I would walk them every 7 to 10 days and count every mushroom species and every individual that I saw there. So I would get quantified pictures of the community at that moment. So this was part of that routine protocol, except that after 2 years, it was no longer routine in Big Basin. It had changed dramatically from regular surveying to pre- and post-fire surveying. That didn't happen to all of my transects, but all of the transects in Big Basin were burned. And I had three of them there. And that's what I was doing. And the community on that date was neither abundant nor diverse. It was sort of the tail end of the spring. But curiously, my first visits back to Big Basin after the fire were characterized by extremely low diversity, but extremely high abundance. So a very small number of species of mushroom were present, but the ones that were present in amazing volumes, amazing quantity of biomass. And that's because they are fire responders or fire adapted species in some way. Species that not only were able to tolerate the burning, but were in fact stimulated by it to produce more biomass than an average forest would produce. So on the day that I think we were filming, it was the first day I had seen morels, which are a famous fire responding species. So that was something I had expected to see and finally caught up to it. And as well as a number of other fire responsive ascomycetes were there on that day. But it's still, I haven't been back recently because I haven't been doing those surveys this year. But every time I went back into Big Basin after the fires, there was some amount of unfamiliarity. The place had changed visually so much that I couldn't find my way all the time in places that I otherwise would have said I knew like the back of my hand. I'd walked those trails so many times, but so many trees had fallen. The canopy was, virtually gone. There were no leaves sheltering the forest floor from the sun. It was hard to tell where I was sometimes, which was very disorienting because I logically knew approximately where I was, but it wasn't always clear where to take the next step to follow my transect. So I think at that time, on that day, I was probably still coping with that sense of unfamiliarity, both the practical problems as well as the sort of emotional weight of it.
For these fire responder mushrooms, is it that like they have more spore stimulation after fire? Is it just because of what the matter on the ground is that they're able to feed off of? Or how does the fire responding work?
They're not all the same. So some of them are in fact responding to the sudden availability of a bunch of pulverized carbon. And they actually respond to the chemistry of the soil afterwards. So more nutrient enrichment or a bunch of dead trees that suddenly become, they have no immune system anymore. So any remnant carbon there is really easy to access. But some of them are in fact doing the opposite. Their food source died. So they were attached to the roots or the living body of the plant in some way. And when that host dies, they suddenly have to reproduce in order to try and disperse their spores because that patch is not going to make it. So curiously, you have multiple drivers of the same sort of pattern, which is a lot of fruit bodies. But some of them are doing that because they're about to die. It's their last ditch effort. Whereas others are doing it because they couldn't make a living there before and now they can.
And the mushrooms that you mentioned at the beginning that kind of got you excited to go to Big Basin, are they still there?
I don't know. And we won't know for a long time.
So maybe unpack that a little bit. Like, what do you see as Big Basin's future, as this fire finally extinguishes and it starts to kind of regrow itself?
It's something I think about a lot. And I don't know what to expect because I have no benchmark for a high-intensity redwood forest burning. This is the only one I've ever seen. And it's the only one most people have ever seen. I did a little bit of emailing around after the fire to see if any of my colleagues had data about what happens in a redwood fire. And the only response I got was one example of a low intensity fire that behaved totally differently. So we basically have no data about this. Whereas in pine ecosystems or in chaparral ecosystems, there's lots and lots of data for what happens after a fire. We know those stories. We can point to data about the ecological succession in other systems, but not in redwood systems, not in old growth redwood systems. So there's very little to turn to. Kind of the only thing we can do is sit and wait and watch. And sadly, I'm not going to live long enough to really see the trajectory. These systems take centuries to establish. It will be up to not just the generation of children born now, but a few generations from them, to tell what the long-term story of Big Basin was in the wake of this fire. And it's amazing to me to think about that, just how long we'll have to wait to know. And even then we won't know because we're changing all the variables that surround it. Perhaps it would have regenerated more or less exactly to what it looked like in 1900, but we're changing the whole world around it. It's getting hotter. It's getting drier. There's invasive species moving into the burn scar. There's management happening. PG&E had to bring large machinery in there to clear out all of the hazard trees around the phone lines and the power cables. So there is no static variable. Everything is a moving piece. And what we see is what we get forever. I mean, there's only so much use in trying to predict when you're also changing the variables you're trying to predict about.
That's a really fascinating note to end on.
It was a pleasure talking with Christian, and I hope after listening to this discussion, you will check out our documentary that features him called Fire Among Giants. It is available on YouTube. We were some of the first people to be able to enter Big Basin after the fire, and our cameras captured this special place in ways never seen before. In addition to Christian, you will meet other guides who will give you an up-close and thought-provoking tour through the Redwoods. We also hope you will check out our other short films at the Science Communication Lab website at www.sciencecommunicationlab.org. There you will also find other audio interviews of the people we featured in Fire Among Giants. Once again, I'm Sarah Goodwin, and I want to thank you for listening. Funding for this production was made possible by a grant from the National Science Foundation.